1983 spring program of lectures of the Vancouver Institute. The one remaining lecture will be on the 9th day of April, which means that there will be a hiatus. No lecture next Saturday, that being Holy Saturday. The one remaining lecture is Jessica Mitford, who will be here on the 9th of April to speak on Inside Muckraking. But we're going to find out this evening about the origin of our universe. She'll tell us, I suppose, something about what's been happening with it over the years. Professor James Peebles is a Canadian. He was born in St. Boniface, Manitoba, and educated there and at the University of Manitoba, where he obtained a Bachelor of Science degree. He earned a PhD at Princeton University in 1961 on gravity physics. And he has been, he tells me, at Princeton off and on since that time. He is now a full professor of physics at Princeton. But this particular year, 1982-83, he's on a sabbatical leave from Princeton, and he is spending this year at the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory on Vancouver Island. One of the highlights, I think, in Dr. Peebles' career must have been the fact that he last year received the Heinemann Prize in astronomy. It is the most prestigious award in astronomy in North America. I'm pleased this evening to present to you Dr. James Peebles, The Origin of the Universe.
Thank you very much. You will have deduced one further property of me, that I have a weakness for grandiose titles up to which I couldn't possibly live. I have no idea how the universe originated. And that is the short version of my talk. The longer version, which I now will give, will convey the message that we might be at last learning enough that we're nibbling at the edge of the problem. And so I will take you on a guide of the edge of a grandiose problem. I think it's good to begin by taking you on a tour of what I conceive to be the visible universe. Let me remind you that in cosmology and astronomy in general, one talks about very large lengths, and so it is useful to use a large distance scale. The convenient one is a measure of how long it takes light to get that distance. So just to set the scale, let us remember that in the solar system, the Earth is some 8 light minutes away from the sun, and that the largest planet, Jupiter, is some 40 light minutes away. It's worth pausing a minute to look at this largest planet in the solar system, Jupiter. And now, if I pass my intelligence test, I will be able to show you a photograph of it. And I will then turn off the lights. That's amazing. And here it is. It's nothing but a gas sphere, hydrogen and helium mainly, compressed by its own weight to a density roughly that of water. Down below, you see the great red spot. We now know that's nothing but a tropical storm, a hurricane. But it's rather a large one. It's lasted a few hundred years. and big enough that if you drop the Earth into it, you wouldn't make much of a dent. This thing is nothing but a star. It has no solid surface, but not quite massive enough to generate light by its own weight, and so it's called a planet. Let us look at the next slide, in which you will see a map of our stellar neighborhood. This is a photograph, unhappily rather vague, but I hope you can make out the dots, of a model to be seen in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, if you should happen to go that way, made by Dr. Sarah Lee Lippincott. It shows all the known stars within a distance of 17 light years from the sun. The central dot, sort of orange one, is the sun. There are some 60 other stars known in this region of space with a radius of some 17 light years. It's interesting to notice that only the four of the stars are more massive than the sun. If you go for that sort of statistic, our sun is a moderately bright star. It's also interesting to notice that many of the stars appear in associations, in tight pairs. In particular, there are 22 tight pairs in 11 tight binary systems that look an awful lot like the Jupiter-Sun system in the sense that there are two gaseous bodies orbiting each other very closely. And the fact that binary stars are so very common has led people to speculate that perhaps also things like binary systems, Jupiter-Earth-Jupiter-Sun systems, might be common also. And if Jupiter-Sun-type systems are common, why aren't Jupiter-Sun-Earth terrestrial planet systems common? If they're common, why aren't civilizations common, and shouldn't we be looking for them? So far, we've received no unambiguous signals, but it certainly seems sensible to keep looking. But this is not yet cosmology. This is still a small-scale structure of the universe. So let us take another step further backward and recall that on a clear night, you can see a band of light running across the sky, the Milky Way. This is now understood, it is thought fairly well. We are in a galaxy of stars, an island universe of stars that is flattened like a pancake. And as we look in directions along the pancake, we see the integrated starlight as a diffuse glow. In the starlight, there are also the dark rifts you see in the photograph. That reflects not absence of stars, it is now known, but rather the obscuring effect of clouds of dust between the stars, interstellar matter. Objects of this sort are not uncommon. This photograph shows again the Milky Way on the bottom, and above it, an extragalactic object, another galaxy of stars, very similar, you can see, to our own Milky Way galaxy. Again, you see the integrated glow of the stars along the disk of this system that again happens to be seen very close to edge on. And going through the glow, the dark rifts due to obscuring interstellar dust. And here's another photograph of another disk-shaped galaxy. This one happens to be presented to us face-on. You see the beautiful spiral structure of it. Other galaxies have a much weaker disk, as in this galaxy, and a much stronger halo of old stars in a sphere around it. We're talking here about scales, the distance across this thing of some tens of thousands of light years. So we're getting up rather big in scale, but we're still not at cosmology. We must take another step further back to look at the larger scale nature of things. This will show you that galaxies tend to appear in associations. Where you find one galaxy, you have a very good chance of finding another close by. Groups of this sort are common. We are in such a group. There are two major members of us, of this group, us and the so-called Andromeda Nebula, and a few dozen minor galaxies in what is called the local group, perhaps not a very imaginative name. Here's another group further away. And let us look at this structure of galaxy distributions in still more detail. We will turn this off by some magic method. No, I killed it. Good. Here is a distribution across the sky of those galaxies that are within a distance of some 100 million light years from us. These are data accumulated by the astronomer Fritz Wicki at Caltech in Berkeley, in Pasadena, California, and distances obtained recently by Mark Davis working at Harvard. One half of the sky is shown here. Part of the sky has no dots in it, no galaxies shown, because these data were taken in the northern hemisphere, and they didn't look that far south. This hemisphere of the sky is so arranged that directions looking along the disk of our galaxy are at the edge, and the center corresponds to looking normal to the disk of our galaxy. No galaxies are seen near the edge, and that is thought not to be surprising, because remember, there's all that obscuring dust around our Milky Way. Toward the center, it is thought we have a fairly clear view out. And as you can see, the galaxies are by no means uniformly distributed. In particular, what strikes you is the very strong concentration of galaxies in this area of the Virgo, called the Virgo cluster, because I suppose it's in the direction of the Virgo constellation. It is surrounded by a halo of stars, of galaxies that isn't so apparent on this map, but we're part of that large halo around the Virgo cluster of galaxies. That's prominent enough to have received the name the local supercluster of galaxies. But this is still yet not the full area of cosmology. We must take another step further back and look at the still larger scale of things. Here is a distribution across the sky of the galaxies within distances of 200 to 300 million light years. Again, one is seeing one hemisphere of the sky. And again, the periphery corresponds to directions looking through the disk of our Milky Way galaxy. And again, the galaxies in those directions are obscured. Toward the center, you notice other objects coming into view, in particular a tight knot right in the center that is called the Coma Cluster of Galaxies. And you can get yet another view of this Coma Cluster of Galaxies in the next map, which shows the distribution across the sky of the galaxies of the nearest 1 million galaxies. This is no longer a shell of galaxies, but rather everything out to a fixed distance, roughly 700 million light years. And this is no longer quite the full hemisphere, but a fraction of it. From one side of the map to the other is about 100 degrees, about this much. In this area, some million galaxies counted by the astronomer Donald Shane, working with Carl Wirtanen at the Lick Observatory in California. I have a deep admiration for Donald Shane because he took these data beginning in the early 1950s. Taken 10 years of his life to count the brightest million galaxies, doing it with a traveling microscope on photographic plates. He was looking one galaxy at a time. When he ended up, he had a thick pile of data sheets and nothing he could do with it, because before the age of high-speed computers, there's nothing much you can do with a million data points. It's too much to handle. But yet he took those data with such scrupulous care that when high-speed computers came along, it was possible to use his data to massage it statistically and to make this map. I, a few years ago, had the great pleasure of taking the map to him. I asked him, well, is this what you expected to see? And he said, no, of course not. How could I know what I was taking? I was looking one galaxy at a time. You can see, I think, that the map is arranged in small squares. And the dark tone in each square corresponds to the number of galaxies seen. Where it's very dark, there are perhaps some tens of galaxies seen in that small square. White means no galaxy seen out to this distance of 700 million light years in the small cell. There are 36 cells in a square degree, so my thumbnail at arm's length is blocking out about 36 of those cells. Notice the Coma Cluster of Galaxies in the foreground looks just like a galaxy, doesn't it? But of course, it's a galaxy of galaxies. Notice the other tendrils, wisps. Here is a view of the universe that we've only recently had, and it's fascinating to view and admire. But I'd like to draw your attention to another aspect of this map that perhaps is less exciting, but yet is very deep. This part looks an awful lot like this part, looks an awful lot like this part. We've stopped running out of interesting new things to see. Another view of that same effect is shown here. On the occasion, a galaxy will explode and give off, for reasons best known only to it, radio radiation. This happens only rarely. When it does, the galaxy is visible at enormous distances, so that if one catalogs the distribution across the sky of the brightest, and one thinks that's roughly the nearest, 5,000 radio galaxies, one is looking a long way out in space. Here's the distribution across the sky of the nearest, roughly the brightest at least, 5,000 radio galaxies. You should ignore the hole in the center. That's an instrumental problem. There are a few other instrumental problems. The brightest radio source in the sky outside the solar system is Cassiopeia A right there. And it is so bright that it confuses the radio telescope and the area around it. And that's why there's a little blank around the radio source. Those effects aside, this distribution is as close to a random homogeneous distribution as you could get with the most expensive random number generator IPM can provide us. On this scale, we've stopped seeing interesting things. The universe has become bland. It's become simple. One part, one direction, just like the other. The universe has become, as best we can tell, homogeneous and isotropic. No preferred place, no preferred direction. That's a startling thing to discover, if you stop and think about it, because we recognize that the world is organized in a hierarchical structure. You could spend your entire career studying, let us say, people or things on the scale of size of people, meter-sized things. Or you could spend your career studying, let us say, planets on scales of tens of thousands of kilometers. Or you could spend your career studying stars on a still larger scale, or clusters of stars, or galaxies, or clusters of galaxies, or superclusters. Or you could choose a smaller scale, cells of which we were made, or the molecules that make up cells, or the atoms that make up molecules, or the atomic nuclei that make up atoms, or the protons and neutrons that make up atomic nuclei, or the quarks we now know that make up protons and neutrons. It's a hierarchy of structures. And on each time we look on a different scale, we see something new and exciting. Except here, we've stopped seeing new things. Now, by the same token, this simplicity is of great importance because it tells us that we can pretend to make a theory of the universe. When one says a theory of the universe, we are talking about this large-scale, homogeneous, simple universe. The simplicity is the reason we can hope to do it. If the universe had new things to teach us on each level of scale, of course, we could never pretend to make a theory of the universe itself, only of a particular object seen on a particular scale. Here it seems we've run out of scales, and so we can start to make a theory of the universe itself. Now there is another property of this universe that's so simple that I must now describe. It seems to be expanding. By expanding, I mean that if you look at a distant galaxy, it seems to be moving away from us. The original evidence for this moving away from us came from the Doppler effect that you're all familiar with if you've listened to an automobile going by on the highway. It has a very characteristic sound. Broom, right? And that is not a result of the automobile's engine intrinsically changing tone as it goes by you, but rather as the automobile is coming towards you, the sound waves are compressed, and so the pitch is increased. And as the automobile moves away from you, sound waves are stretched, pitch decreased. Same effect is observed with light, observed in the laboratory, and is certainly well understood. It is observed that the light from a galaxy is shifted toward the red, as if the galaxy were moving away from us. And the further the galaxy is away, the greater that shift toward the red, the greater the apparent velocity of motion away from us. Now we should stop and think about that effect for a while because it's a little confusing until you do give it some thought. And then perhaps you will agree that it's rather neat. I hope this is going to work. I've brought along a working model of an expanding universe, so let us try it. Here is the universe. It's full of galaxies. And now here we have an observer, a little green man, who lives on this particular spiral galaxy. It's the Milky Way galaxy. And the little green man observes that galaxies are moving away from him. This is the expansion of the universe. It says only that you sit on a galaxy and you see that galaxies are moving away from you. The further the galaxy is, the greater the recession velocity. I've drawn a longer arrow to represent that. And the little green man is now entitled to say, wow, the universe isn't homogeneous after all. It's centered on me. The universe is expanding away from me. Right? The universe is no longer homogeneous. It has an edge. But now on another galaxy, there is a little purple woman who says, wait. I'm having a little trouble with my demonstration here, but let me get it arranged. Now, I hope we can argue this through and you can be convinced of what I'm saying. The little purple woman says, wait, I'm not moving away from you. You're moving away from me. I'm at the center of the universe. I see this galaxy here moving away from me. You see, that can be consistent with what the little green man says, because he sees this galaxy moving away at a small velocity since it's close to him. The little purple woman moving away more rapidly because she's further away, and so she will see this galaxy moving away from her. Follow the argument through with another galaxy. This one is rather far away from the little green man, and so is moving away from him quite rapidly. It's rather closer to the little purple woman. She's moving away from the little green man. He sees this galaxy moving away from him rather rapidly, and so she sees it moving away from her less rapidly. And so if you think this thing through, I think you can discover what is true, that each observer sitting on each galaxy can see the same thing. The universe is expanding away from me. It is the one expansion law, recession velocity directly proportional to distance, that allows each observer to see the same thing, that allows the universe to be expanding and yet homogeneous, to be expanding yet have no edge and no center. A remarkably neat arrangement, I think. And it might even be the way the universe is arranged, as I'll argue now. Before I go on to the strongest evidence in favor of an expanding universe, I should just remark that if indeed the universe is expanding, then we can say how old the universe is. We know the expansion rate. We trace the expansion back in time and ask, at what point in time was the universe exceedingly dense? At what point in time did the expansion stop? That estimate for the age of the universe comes out to be 10 to 20 billion years. It's not very accurately known, because although it's pretty convincingly shown, I think, that redshift is proportional to distance, that recession velocity is proportional to distance, it's very difficult to get that constant of proportionality. That's why you are liable to turn on the television news some evening and discover that the age of the universe has changed. Astronomers are working very hard to compute, to measure through observations that expansion rate, but it's not an easy measurement to make, and so it's sure to be revised from time to time, and that's why I put rather generous uncertainties, 10 to 20 billion years for the age of the universe from the rate of expansion of it. Now, the interesting test one can make is to ask, is that a reasonable value for the age of the universe? In particular, are stars and planets that old? A couple of tests can be made. First, some elements, like uranium, are radioactive and so decay. In particular, the isotope U-235 is mercifully very rare. I say mercifully because it's the stuff that can be used to make big explosions. And it's fortunate that it's very rare compared to other isotopes of uranium, like U-238. It took people an awful long time to assemble enough to make a big explosion. Well, U-235 isn't rare because it was made rare. It's rare because it decays rather rapidly on the scale of billions of years. Knowing, therefore, the abundance of U-235 and how fast it decays, one can reckon how old uranium is. The ages, depending on how you do the calculation, come out to around 7 to 15 billion years. One can look at stars. Stars don't last forever because they burn hydrogen to helium, and after the hydrogen and helium is thoroughly burned, they tend to explode or otherwise turn off. By studying the theory of that, one can come up with an age of the oldest stars. Present numbers cluster around 16 billion years. Now, the fascinating thing about this is that all these numbers are in the same ballpark. And if we were quite wrong about interpreting this redshift of the galaxies as due to expansion, it would be a miraculous coincidence, very unlikely, I would claim, that the age one reckons from this apparent expansion should agree with the age, say, of uranium, caused by looking at the abundance of U-235 and asking how rapidly it decays. This coincidence, then, is rather strong encouragement to us to think that we must be on the right track. It seems to, as the right smell, we can actually date the age of the universe. And of course, if we're going to ask the question, where did the universe come from, it is encouraging to think that we can at least get that far along the way, we can say, well, we know when it came into being. Let us say, as a good working number, 15 billion years ago, subject to revision of 50%, but that's all right. Now let us turn back to another aspect of the expanding universe, that it seems to be filled with black body radiation. I've brought along a working model of that. here is our universe, and I've put in a lot of photons, particles of light. I filled the universe with it, so I put them in uniformly, and because the universe has no preferred center, I put these little arrows in random directions. Think of a gas of particles uniformly filling space, moving about in all directions. This gas of particles is, in fact, a gas of light or electromagnetic radiation, radio radiation, for example, that is thought to be left over from the Big Bang, from the start of expansion of the universe. And it is black body radiation of the sort you're all familiar with. For example, if you have a wood-burning stove, and if you get too enthusiastic about feeding fuel to the wood-burning stove, the walls will get very hot, and when they get very hot indeed, they will start to glow a dull orange. That is black body radiation, and it's been known for some time that it has a very convenient property. You tell me the temperature of the material that's doing the radiating, and I will tell you the intensity of the radiation given off at each wavelength. Goes back to Max Planck, black body radiation, physically well understood. If indeed the universe is expanding, and if it started out hot, being hot and dense, it would have made black body radiation with a definite amount per unit volume at each wavelength. And now ask yourself what happens to the universe, to the radiation as the universe expands. Of course, the radiation can't be lost. It has nowhere to go. The universe is everywhere, no boundaries. But the universe is getting bigger in the sense that the distance between galaxies is opening up. And so this radiation must become more and more dilute. At the same time, the radiation is being shifted toward the red, the same effect I discussed with respect to galaxies. What is the net effect of this? Well, it is, as it happens, through a very fortunate coincidence, to cool off the black body radiation, but to keep it black body in character. It's very similar to the effect that happens in an automobile engine during the power stroke. As the cylinder opens up, the gases inside are cooled, doing work against the cylinder, but they remain in thermal equilibrium. Same game here. The expansion of the universe is cooling the radiation, but keeping it black body in character. It's worth reminding you of a little, or telling you of a little, of the history of this idea, since it's of some interest. It was first seriously rooted about, well, did I get something? Ah, good. All right, by George Gamow in the late 1940s. He and a student, Ralph Elfer, worked on some consequences of this notion of a hot expanding universe. That thesis of Ralph Elfer got into the newspapers and inspired this cartoon by Herblock. It's of some historical interest since it's one of the first times that he used this symbol for the hydrogen bomb. At just the same time that Gamow and Elfer were working out this theory of a hot expanding universe, Bob Dickey, who was my thesis advisor at Princeton, was standing on a rooftop at MIT playing with a device he had invented during World War II as part of the radar research at MIT called a microwave radiometer. It's that thing with the horn. He is holding a shaggy dog in front of it, which is his whimsical name for a black body at room temperature, 300 degrees above absolute zero. The radiometer he had invented was just the thing for measuring black body radiation of the sort that would be left over from the Big Bang. Unhappily, he didn't at the time know about Gamow's work, and Gamow and Elfer didn't know that Dickey had invented just the apparatus that could be used to test their theory, and so nothing became of this coincidence until some 20 years later, when it occurred to Bob Dickey that it really would be reasonable to look for black body radiation in the universe using his detector. And he persuaded these two young fellows, Dave Wilkinson on the right, holding a screwdriver, I think you can just make out, and looking very intelligent, and Peter Roll coyly hiding behind the Dickey radiometer, to build this device to look for black body radiation coming out of the Big Bang. When word of this came to Arnold Penzias on the left here and Bob Wilson at Holmdel, New Jersey, they were very delighted because they had been set the task of discovering why this telescope, which is again similar to a Dickey radiometer, was showing more radiation than it ought to have. This telescope was built in the first echo telecommunications experiments, you know, in which a TV program is broadcast up to a satellite where it bounces off and is received by small antennae and causes all sorts of political problems in Canada. The engineers who built this antenna were disconcerted to discover that it showed a little bit more noise than it should have, as if it were receiving radiation from space. But one was very reluctant to believe that that was the case until all sources of local radiation had been observed. These two guys wanted to use this telescope for radio astronomy. They were told by their very canny bosses that before they use this instrument for astronomy, they really ought to understand it. And so they had worked very hard to track down all possible sources of local noise within the receiver. It's an interesting measure of human nature that when they heard of the Princeton experiment, their first reaction was, well, now at last we can forget about this silly effect and go on and do some science. Well, here was the status of affairs then. In 1965, I believe it is, when Penzias and Wilson had at last convinced themselves that their telescope was seeing something other than internally generated noise. The situation was complicated. They were receiving noise at a wavelength of 7 centimeters. Now, that in itself, that they're receiving noise, is not suspicious because, as I remarked, some galaxies do explode. And those exploding galaxies do make a general radio background. The only thing that seems suspicious is that the amount of radiation they were receiving was much greater than the amount you would expect to receive if you extrapolated the longer wavelength measurements where the radio sources were, galaxies were clearly detected. So there was something suspicious, but really only something suspicious. I well remember showing this slide at the American Physical Society meeting in New York City. Quavering young postdoc, and I remember at last I got a vivid demonstration of what it means to hear a titter run through the audience. Okay, but in any case, here's the point. If this theory that this is black body radiation left over from the Big Bang is right, then knowing one point on here, the amount of energy at one wavelength, one can specify the temperature, which was about 3 degrees Kelvin. Knowing the temperature, one could predict what the intensity would be at any other wavelength. And all you had to do then was to go out and build apparatuses to measure the intensity at other wavelengths and see whether it marched up and down the way it should. A pretty bold gamble to predict ahead of time that this is what it should look like, but of course I'm only stressing this because it worked out so well. Just for scenic interest, now let us look at Peter Salson, who was here standing in front of an apparatus that was flow on action in a balloon to measure this black body radiation. And there is one of the reasons it's fun to do science. You get to see sights such as this, a balloon going up at sunset. Let us now look at some data on this radiation. Here is the original discovery wavelength of Penzias and Wilson. Here was a 3-centimeter experiment of Roland Wilkinson, came on the air soon afterward, and it was a great excitement to us all to see that it fell on the predicted curve. Here are other measurements marching up to the peak. I didn't bring along, and I will only have to ask you to take my word for it, the data going over the peak of the black body curve. It does fall over the peak the way it should. There are small discrepancies over at the shortest wavelengths. The experiments are exceedingly difficult. Are sure to be refined. At the moment, it looks awfully good. It looks as though these data points do fall along the curve the way they should. And that's a result of very, very great importance, because it's awfully hard to see how the universe in its present state could ever make radiation with this very characteristic black body shape. It seems, therefore, that the universe must have expanded from a dense state when it was able to make black body radiation because it was opaque, able to relax to thermal equilibrium. Here, I like to think, is the best analog we have of dinosaur footprints. Dinosaur footprints, I would say, are tangible evidence that we really were objects like dinosaurs that walked the face of the Earth. Here, in a similar spirit, is something almost tangible that allows us to say, yes, the universe must have expanded. Otherwise, how in the world did it make this radiation? This effect was what convinced most people that the universe surely is expanding. Tangible evidence. Well, let us accept then that the universe is expanding and think about some of the physics of the expansion. I think it's useful to show a movie simulating the expanding universe. This movie might confuse you if you're a Star Wars fan, because you will have the impression that you're seeing a set of dots rushing toward you. That is not the case. Instead, you must imagine that you're seeing a set of dots at a fixed distance from you, and the set is expanding into space. This is a simulation of the expanding universe. Of course, I haven't shown the whole universe, because, of course, that would leave no room for you. So we must hollow out a section of the universe and look at it alone. It is a spherical section, contains some 300 mass points. The mass points are set to move away from each other in accordance with this law of the general recession I mentioned. The further the point is away from the center, the faster it's moving away. Two effects are operating here, kinetic energy, the points are being thrown out, and potential energy, gravity is decelerating the expansion. And the motions of the particles under these effects were computed, and then a film made. And now, I think I press film, and forward, and we hope for the best. Oh, I should have turned off. No. Yeah, okay. Well, I'd like for you to see two effects. First, you saw the expansion rapid at first and slowing down. That's the decelerating effect of gravity. And one question hotly debated is gravity strong enough to stop the expansion entirely, cause the universe to recollapse into a big crunch? Or, if the density of the universe is small enough, must we expect that the universe is doomed to expand forever? Hotly debated, I've decided not to talk about that subject today, but another aspect of it. Oh, but let me point out the second important feature here. I hope it's crossed your mind that the distribution is growing more clumpy as time goes on, and that this clumpiness is not dissimilar to the clumpy distribution of galaxies. The reason the universe grows clumpy is easy enough to see. The universe is unstable, gravitationally unstable against breaking up into lumps, and that's because of this decelerating effect of gravity. In the initial distribution, there were minute irregularities. Where the density happened to be slightly higher than average, the gravitational acceleration will be slightly stronger than average and pull that portion of the universe, slow it, more rapidly than the mean. Having done that, of course, that portion will become still more dense relative to the mean. Gravity will be still more important, and eventually that small portion of the universe will stop expanding. And so it seems that we have, at least in outline, a picture for why the universe is the way it is. Clumpy on small scales, that's this instability. Smooth on large scales. Well, that is an instant replay in which I've taken out the general expansion of the universe, and you see here only the peculiar motions, that is to say, the motion over and above the general expansion. We might as well let it run until I need to show something else, because at least it's something to look at and occupy your mind with while we go on. Oh, yes, and now I come to the horrible part. I hope I've convinced you up to this point that there is something to all this notion of an expanding universe, that this is not pure speculation or philosophy, that this is science as we understand it, namely, that one can make a theory that has consequences that can be tested by measurement. And if the tests work, you have confidence that, yes, this must be an aspect of reality. One never pretends these days, it's long since out of fashion, that we are seeing absolute truth, only approximations to it. But when you make measurements and the measurements agree with the theory, you are encouraged to believe that you are on the track of truth. You are on an approximation to it that is useful. And I hope I've convinced you so far that's the case here. We are on the track of something that smells right. But I want to go on now and talk about something that smells terrible, namely, what do we do about this question of the origin of the universe? To deal with that, well, I guess now we can thoroughly kill it. Let us go on and talk about another aspect. Thank you. of physics. Here is a photograph of yet another galaxy, a galaxy that has no disk we can speak of, but rather has a very ill-looking splotch of material running through it, as if the galaxy had suffered an explosion. And indeed, there's good reason to believe that's the case. Here is a photograph of that same galaxy, as it would appear if your eyes were able to detect radio radiation rather than the much shorter optical radiation. It seems that the galaxy exploded and shot from it enormous numbers of very energetic particles and magnetic fields. The particles moving through the magnetic fields are accelerated, make radio radiation, and that's what is detected in this plot. Well, that part of the picture seems to hang together very well. The details of this radiation match rather well what you would expect under this interpretation, so I suggest we adopt it and go on. I might remark that the optical galaxy itself is centered and would be about the size of those two reddish spots right in the middle. The great lobes are well outside the galaxy. Obviously, something very energetic has happened here. The galaxy has exploded and violently and shot out particles at enormous speed. Here's another example I show only because it's so pretty of a galaxy that has exploded. The galaxy itself is that central dot, and you see a symmetric explosion going out either way, extending over some hundreds of millions of light years. Something violent is going on here. Let us go on and look at another galaxy that looks exceedingly ordinary. Here is an elliptical galaxy, so-called, in which there is no disk at all. It's a halo of old stars, and in this view seems to be exceedingly dull, just a collection of old stars. But if you look in the center under great seeing, you will discover that the object has some remarkable properties. The bottom photograph shows the very centermost part of the galaxy under the best magnification astronomers have been able to obtain. This photograph obtained, in fact, by the astronomer Chip Arp at the Hale Observatories in California. At the center, there is a bright spot, which is hidden in the bottom photograph, but if you take out the general starlight, as was attempted to do by Arp in the upper photograph, you see a dense spot, very dense, and running away from that dense spot, a stream, a jet. That dense spot has a very strong source of radio radiation that is unresolved with the best telescopes on the Earth. Obviously, a very energetic event going on here, and I propose we turn our attention to what that energetic event might be. Later on, you will see at least roughly why I should introduce this into a talk on the origin of the universe. Well, let us recall the nature of gravity. Gravity unceasingly strives to bring matter together, as Harold Lloyd is discovering to his discomfort. Gravity pulls things. And let us stop and think about what that means for something as massive as a galaxy. Here is a photograph, again, of the galaxy that I showed you earlier. Here is the central spike of light in that galaxy. Here, very crudely reproduced, I'm afraid, but yes, you can see it, is the jet of light running away from the galaxy. The halo of stars is circularly distributed about this point. Now, stars tend to give off gas, and gas tends to lose energy through collisions, and when it loses energy, it tends to settle toward the direction of gravity, which is represented by these red arrows. And so as time goes on, matter is going to tend to pile up in the center of this galaxy, as it obviously has. And we know that matter in great quantities is explosive for a couple of reasons. First, it can ignite thermonuclear reactions. And second, gravity can become very strong when matter is piled very close together. The stronger matter is piled together, the more tightly gravity will bind the matter. Eventually, we know, if we believe the best theory we have, general relativity, gravity will be so strong that it will bind even light to the object, and we will get a black hole in the center. When material that falls into that black hole is going to get very hot, and when material is hot, it tends to explode, and it's thought that perhaps that's what caused this jet running out. Simply an explosion of material collecting in and around something that looks like a black hole. Now, it's thought that this black hole is relevant to this question of where the universe came from, and let's turn our attention to that bit of physics. I'd like to describe very briefly the physics of a black hole. Okay, now this has got to be a little bit complicated, but let's grit our teeth and think it through. This is a space-time diagram. Time is going up. Space is going sideways, and you must bend your mind and think of three dimensions sideways, right? This way, and some other way to represent space. In this diagram, light rays are 45-degree lines. So the fastest anything can travel is at 45-degree slope. Any material particle will travel less rapidly, and I've indicated a couple of such trajectories as the black lines. Now, there is in this region of space a star, and the star is so massive that it is collapsing. Gravity is so strong that it's able to overwhelm the force of pressures that normally hold stars up, and this vague orange line is the surface of the star, which is collapsing. As the collapse of the star proceeds, gravity gets stronger until finally, according to general relativity, space is warped and we form a black hole. And as time goes on, inside that black hole, space ends. Time ends. The theory becomes inoperative, and all one can say is we no longer know how to compute. As material approaches this singularity, it's torn apart in diverging tidal fields. That part can be computed, but when you get to this line, you're lost. We don't know what's going on. Theory fails. And it's thought that that's not because the world, in fact, comes to an end at that point, but rather that because we need a better theory. As I've stressed, one no longer believes that any physical theory is absolute reality. They're all known to be approximations. In particular, we know that general relativity has to be an approximation because it's not consistent with the other great theory of physics we have, quantum mechanics. The two in their separate fields are very successful, but together they're inconsistent. This black hole physics leads to all sorts of paradoxical or seemingly paradoxical events, such as the history of an observer. A and B down here leave each part company. B chooses to stay close to the black hole and is very foolish indeed. A keeps well away from it and lives forever, at least until the world should come to an end or otherwise things get into trouble, without ever running into this black hole. But once B has come within this horizon, you can see that the B is inevitably doomed to be torn apart by this singularity, because no matter how fast B moves in either direction, it must hit this singularity. So it's totally guaranteed to be crushed out of existence. As B, who looks ahead and notices how foolish he was, approaches this black hole, he can still see A back here along a light cone. A, on the other hand, as he goes on his way, will see B, for example, at this point. A sees B down here. You'll notice that as A goes off to infinity, he never does see B cross this horizon. And so there is a wonderful cosmic censorship here. We never see the dreadful end of B, even though, in fact, if you're B, you come to the dreadful end in a definite and limited amount of time. Well, now, to come back to this fundamental question, what do we make of this end of time in the theory? As I stressed, few people believe that explicitly time ends there. Rather, it's more likely that the physics is inadequately understood. One suspects, in fact, that perhaps there was a bounce and the time recommenced. And what is reinforced in that view by noticing another aspect of the theory. I had in here a star that produced the black hole. Theory says I can equally well remove the star and have a black hole that had no star to produce it, but rather that began all by itself. And in this solution, there is a curious property. Classical time begins at a finite place. I can now have an observer at this point moving away in a perfectly free and easy way from the black hole. That observer could leave and join A, or that observer could be so foolish as to join B and be crushed again at the other end of time. One has then the notion of time beginning and time ending. Is that all there is to time? Well, I'm reluctant to believe it, and a fashionable thing to imagine is that when we reach the end of classical time, we have a bounce, and classical time begins again, and we carry on. Let us push that idea a little bit and arrive at what the Belgian cosmologist Lemaître, the Abbé Georges Lemaître, very aptly called the Phoenix Universe. So here we are now in this Phoenix universe. Time is increasing to the right, and the size of the universe, very crudely, is represented as a vertical direction. The universe is now expanding, and so the size is increasing with time. I require in this model for the universe and how it began the assumption that the universe is massive enough to contract. As it does, the black body radiation, which is present, will be reheated, and the universe will become very hot as it approaches this big crunch. As the universe becomes very hot, it will heat the surface of stars. The surfaces of the stars will be required to evaporate. And as we approach this big crunch singularity, stars will evaporate and we will be returned to a free gas. The free gas will be rich in heavy elements like iron and carbon and nitrogen, of which we are made. If we want to be a phoenix, we must eliminate those heavy elements because we can't, after all, convert all the hydrogen into heavy elements. We wouldn't have any more stars. But that is arranged because at high enough temperatures, even atomic nuclei evaporate and go down to their constituent parts, protons and neutrons. We then require an act of faith, or rather an act of a better physics, to tell us what happens at this point. If you believe the physics we have today, the answer is a singularity and then the loss of ability to compute. The guess is that if we had a better physics, we would get a bounce. And we would carry on away again with our phoenix refurbished, the hydrogen reproduced from iron by thermal evaporation, no stars, the stars to be made, the heavy elements to be produced in the stars, and the game to be played once again. It seems likely that the game isn't cyclic, however, because you've heard of entropy, I suspect. And entropy is conserved, one would expect, in a bounce such as this, so the universe is going to get hotter and hotter in each bounce. The hotter a universe, the more mass it has, and the greater the radius of oscillation. And so we have a universe that bounces higher on each oscillation, and therefore takes longer to bounce. So we have the notion that in the beginning, there was a twitch, and the twitch made a universe that went like that. But of course, it made a little entropy, so the next time it had to bounce a little higher, and a little higher, and a little higher, and here we are. Now, you notice I haven't solved the problem, because if we believe that entropy is conserved or increases, I must have a finite number of bounces. The universe can't have been bouncing forever, and so I haven't solved the problem. I don't know what happened here. But you can see, perhaps, that although I don't know how to answer the question I posed at the beginning, I do know how to think about some of the peripheral questions that go along with it. In particular, there's great reason to hope that if we continue to study black holes, those objects found apparently in the centers of galaxies, and perhaps also randomly here and there in galaxies where massive stars have collapsed, we might start to learn some of the physics of gravity under extreme conditions. That's clearly what we need to understand what the universe is doing at these bounces. Expanding, I think clearly it is. Whether the universe will keep on expanding, whether it will recontract, an open question. If it does recontract, what it will do at this bounce, a wide open question. But I hope I've convinced you at least we can meaningfully think about the question. Thank you. Yes.
Last question.
Okay. Sure.
If you repose the question.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Peebles will answer questions. If you direct them to him, to try to repeat.
There's been some controversy about whether the interpretation of the redshift means an expansion, and what is the alternative suggestion if that is not what it is?
Perhaps it would be helpful to repeat the question. It is remarked that there is controversy over this interpretation of the redshift of the light from galaxies as due to expansion, and if not expansion, then what is the interpretation? 20 years ago, the controversy was very lively. I think the black body radiation effect I described is the strongest, most compelling reason to think that the universe really is expanding, that the redshift really is due to the Doppler effect. If the redshift were not due to Doppler effect, it would require new physics that, to my knowledge, has not yet been discovered. The sources of redshift that people can think of, for example, one could imagine that light is scattered off particles and loses energy due to the scattering, won't do, because that sort of process shifts the energy in a random way and broadens the frequency distribution, which we can't allow. So I don't know of any alternative explanation to the Doppler effect. And so far as I can see, the Doppler effect is what we want to account for black body radiation phenomenon.
Is there a theory about the origin of matter in the stellar scene?
Is there a theory about the origin of matter in the stellar scene?
Yeah.
Now, do you mean the origin of, say, hydrogen, of helium, or of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, or do you mean the origin of protons, the constituents of matter? Well, perhaps I could make some comments about both. It is thought that the material that we're made of, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, and all those other beneficial trace elements, were produced in stars from hydrogen as part of the energy source for the stars, and that the stars then exploded and broadcast these material out into space to be incorporated in subsequent generations of stars and planets. That theory seems to work. One can see stars explode, and one can see that these stars are enriched in heavy elements. Where, though, did the hydrogen come from? Well, there is a theory for that that is quite recent. Hydrogen is made of protons. Protons are thought to be very rigorously conserved, or at least have thought to be, up until recently, that a proton was eternal, like a diamond. It has recently been speculated, though, in the context of elementary particle theories, that protons might not be eternal, that they might decay, and that they might also be produced at high enough temperatures. The current speculation, and it is a bit of a fad, I must stress, is that in the very earliest stages of the expansion of the universe, when the temperature was exceedingly high, there were no protons, only heat. But that when the temperature dropped to, now can I quote you a temperature in degrees, 1,000 billion degrees, conditions were right for some of that heat to be transformed into protons by a theory that has been explicitly written down by people like Steven Weinberg, that seems to be self-consistent, but that by no means has been proved. The best potential test for this theory is another consequence of it, that not only can protons be produced, they can decay. And so there are large experiments that hope to detect the decay, the spontaneous decay of protons. What you do in these experiments is very simple. You find yourself a salt mine or something else very big, very deep in the ground. You want to go well underground to avoid cosmic rays, which will be spurious events. You will then fill this cavern with water. And you will put detectors of light flashes, photoscintillators, around the edges of the water. And you will wait for flashes of light, indicating that something energetic happened spontaneously in the middle of this vat of water. So far, there are hints that perhaps protons are decaying, but they're not yet convincing. The time required for a proton to decay, if it does, is something like 10 to the 31 years. That is, 31 zeros before a 1, after a 1, years. So I wouldn't worry. I mean, our protons are quite all right for our need, but it is conceivable that protons do have a finite life.
Observing that one particular. Is
there any significance in the fact that all this hits us all at the same time, although it originated at various times?
Of course, if we looked at a later, I think I understand what you mean, and perhaps I can draw a diagram to try and make it a little clearer. Oh, what was the question? Is there any significance? Can I draw? Yes, I can. We are sitting at a given instant of time, and on the time scale of the universe, we see only a snapshot of it. We see various objects at various distances, and we see them as they are not now, but in the past. Can I draw a diagram in which time is increasing upward? Again, a space-time diagram. Space, x, in this direction. We are here. Here is a distant galaxy. Here is a pen that doesn't... Yep, there it is. At the same time, we don't see that galaxy. Rather, we see that galaxy as it was over at an earlier time. We see it. I will try another pen. Along this light ray. We look at nearby galaxies. We see them only in the recent past. We look at very distant objects, the most distant radio sources. We see them when the universe was much smaller than it is now, back over here. If we could return to the universe in a billion years, we would see along a different light cone. Since radio sources last only a very limited amount of time, we would no longer see this particular radio source, but another galaxy that was here, not visible as a radio source, would have exploded by then and be visible to us. We are seeing then a slice of the universe, it's true, but only a slice. I don't know whether I can repeat all that. Is there a theory that the universe is thought to be is expanding because it is inside, could we call it a super universe, a superspace, and that the forces of gravity within the superspace are causing the universe to expand? I think not, although one can always make remarks, and I perhaps should make some. You could ask the question, what causes the universe to expand? What pushed it? What was the source of the explosion? Don't know. The universe now is coasting. No force is required to keep it expanding, of course, that's inertia. Once set expanding, it will continue to do so. All we observe is that gravity seems to be slowing the expansion. Into what is the universe expanding? Do we need another space into which the universe expands? Let me only caution you here that our understanding of the world is based on intuition, which is to say experience or wired in, whatever it is, on scales of meters. And we understand intuitively very well the nature of space on scales of meters, kilometers. But our intuition needn't work on the enormously large scales that I described here. And in particular, our intuition that if something is expanding into something else, needn't apply on these large scales. And in fact, if you believe general relativity theory, which I have adopted throughout, you don't need a new space, a new dimension in which to expand. It's just not required. I'm sorry that that can't make that intuitive, but of course I can only apologize that my intuition, like yours, is built on the wrong scale.
You mentioned that the further the object is away, the faster it is moving. On what basis do you base this?
Well, again, it is not my observations, but rather the exquisitely detailed and careful and long observations of many astronomers. Well, the question is, on what do you base this statement that the recession velocity is proportional to the distance of the galaxy away? It is based, as I remarked, on the redshift, the fact that if you look at the spectrum, the light from a distant galaxy, you find that the characteristic features in it, the emission lines due to the atomic species, are all shifted over toward the red by a fixed factor for each galaxy. And it is that shift over toward the red that is quite marked, no one debates that it's there, that suggests to us that the galaxy is moving away from us. Way at the back. Would I comment on quasi-stellar objects? My bet is that quasi-stellar objects are just like the objects I showed you at the end, the exploding galaxies, in which the explosion, which occurs in the center, the minimum of the potential well where gravity is pulling things, is more violent even than in the cases you saw here. So violent that the nucleus, the light from the nucleus, outshines the light from the galaxy. And so you see an apparently stellar object. That's beginning to seem more and more likely, because as astronomers examine these quasi-stellar objects with more and more detail, they notice that it seems inevitably there is a little fuzz of light, as if starlight, around the bright stellar object that is so prominent.
Yes. What is the period of the vibrations that come in on the radio scope? I mean, are they all just a steady hum?
Well, it's noise. It's shh, noise. The photographs I showed you, the color maps, were taken at 20 centimeters wavelength. Is that about 20 centimeters? Good. Yeah. Yes?
Is that red shift consistently greater for every object farther away from us? And if that is so, could it be a characteristic of the way we measure greater distances?
Question is it systematically so that the redshift is toward the red, the shift is toward the red, and that the greater the distance, the greater the shift? And could that be a systematic error in the measurements? Could it be that as you look at fainter and fainter objects, the systematic measurement errors that are always present cause you to erroneously think you're seeing a shift toward the red? I think the answer is pretty clearly no. I'm sorry I didn't bring along a spectrum similar to the black body spectrum you saw of a galaxy, showing the amount of radiation emitted at each wavelength. And in some galaxies, one sees very strong spikes in this spectrum because the common elements in the interstellar gas are giving off light with very well-defined frequencies. That's spectroscopy, well understood on the Earth as a method of analyzing contents of things, and applies equally well to galaxies. It's these strong spikes in the spectrum that are seen to shift over toward the red. And they're unambiguously seen even at enormous distances.
What's the difference between saying that space is expanding and that physical bodies are shrinking?
Good point. What is the difference between the statement space is expanding and that we are shrinking, our rulers are shrinking? None at all. It's equivalent, isn't it? Of course, it would be meaningless to say everything is expanding, rulers, space, because that's a vacuous statement. We can only say that relative to an agreed-upon standard, let us say the wavelength of a particular atomic transition, the wavelength of light from an argon laser, relative to that standard, the distance between galaxies is increasing. Yes? Yes. Yes. Well, I'll try and say that again because I think it's so important. I think you're referring to this graph. I'm getting medicine here. We don't want that. Oh. This curve is the thing that excites people. It was first measured in the laboratory It is the spectrum you get from a so-called black body, an object that's relaxed the thermal equilibrium. Not like the radiation that comes from a galaxy, which is well off thermal equilibrium. If you had measured a galaxy, you would see spikes. Oh, I should have told you these dotted lines are the emission from our atmosphere. Again, notice the characteristic wiggles, because again, our atmosphere is not in thermal equilibrium. They're only shown on this diagram because they're a source of experimental error. At short wavelengths, you have to go up in balloons to get away from the emission of light from our atmosphere. If you looked at the spectrum of a galaxy, you would see a similar sort of effect, strong peaks due to particular atoms and molecules radiating at rather well-defined wavelengths. It's only when you have a black body, a body relaxed to thermal equilibrium, that you see this very smooth and characteristic shape. And we get so excited about this spectrum for the integrated background because we can only think it was produced in thermal equilibrium. Yes? Yeah, no. What is there between galaxies? A hotly debated question. There can't be too much because space between galaxies is remarkably clear, transparent. You look at the most distant galaxies, and you see very little, if any, indication that the light has been scattered, for example, by dust. And if you look in the radio, you can look for the effects of atoms, which tend to absorb particular radio wavelengths. And again, you see nothing. So if there is something between galaxies, it's very dilute. I can give you a number. There is less than one proton per cubic meter between the galaxies. So here's a cubic meter, one proton. In this room, in this cubic meter, how many protons are there? 10 to the 25th, right? Did I get that right? 10 to the 25th, roughly. So it's a considerable vacuum. Yes. And you are thinking of random motion on large scales, wouldn't you? Well, you might have expected that, but that's not what's seen.
Not seen by us.
Not seen by us.
But if you were standing in another galaxy,
yes. I wouldn't want to use the word random motion because I say again, that's not what's seen. It's very systematic. The word expansion, of course, has to be taken under advisement. It's not, again, a fully intuitive concept. What seems to be the case is that the distance between galaxies is increasing. Sit on one galaxy, you see that distant galaxy moving away from you. Sit on the distant galaxy, look at us, you see us moving away from the observer. It's relativity of motion, isn't it? Well, yes.
Well, yes, but if you see a galaxy between the two,
yes.
Which way is it moving?
Ah, depends on who you ask. But you are on one galaxy, I am on another, and you are in between. I say, you're moving away from me at moderately low speed. You are moving away from me rather more rapidly. You say just the same thing. You see him moving away from you moderately slowly, me more rapidly. And you can see how that would work, can't you? That we would agree on that. You, on the other hand, will see both of us moving away at moderate speed. Yes.
My mind sort of goes to tilt. If you have an infinite number of objects, and each of them is moving away from each other,
yes.
You know, they're moving in each of them in an infinite number of directions. That becomes ridiculous. I wonder if there's
Well, I did warn you about the dangers of intuition. But I better leave it at that. Yes?
Is there any theory as to where in the universe the Big Bang originated?
Is there any theory as to where in the universe the Big Bang originated? Not fair, right? I said there is no center to the universe. There is no edge. I hate to sound metaphysical, almost metaphysical. The Big Bang must have been everywhere because space is uniform and every point equivalent to every other, so that at the Big Bang, it was occurring everywhere.
I thought my theory was that all matter in the universe was concentrated in a very, very small volume at the time of the Big Bang.
Yes, but that volume filled all space because there was no edge. All right, the natural question to this is there an outside? Well, of course, I don't know. But when I look at the deepest maps we have, I don't see any evidence of an outside. We should look again at the universe and notice that we don't see any evidence of an outside. Now, beyond the most distant objects, it's possible there's something new to be seen. And I don't know how we'll ever know, because we can only look as far as we can look. I should remark that these distances are put at about 10,000 million years, because the universe is about 10,000 million years old, and so that's as far as light can travel in the available time. And there's no way we can see beyond these objects. There's no way we can know what's beyond these objects until we wait another few billion years. And light can travel that far. Yes? At the outer edge, yes, the question is, what is happening at the outer edge of what we can see? The objects are moving at the velocity of light. And that's why we can just see them. Beyond that point, the theory says, objects are moving faster than the velocity of light. That shouldn't disturb you. Well, perhaps it should disturb you, but it's not inconsistent with what we know about physics. In the laboratory, the theory that describes high velocities is special relativity theory. It is well tested in particle accelerators. It works, and it says particles can't move faster than the velocity of light. No velocities can be faster than the velocity of light of material objects. But that theory, like any other, is an approximate one. And we have a generalization of special relativity called general relativity. In general relativity, in fact, material objects can have relative velocities greater than the velocity of light. It's just that they can't be then seen. It's a sneaky way out, I admit. But. Yes. Very good. If the universe started in a very dense state, it was surely in a black hole. And haven't we been instructed that black holes are so called because nothing can come out of them, so they are dead black? But remember, there are two sorts of black holes. General relativity is invariant under time reversal. So for everything that can go in one direction, something can go in, there's another solution which goes in the opposite direction. And so corresponding to a black hole is something that might be called a white hole. And I showed you a drawing of one. Let me remind you. Where is my white hole drawing? I should learn to be neat. Ah, here it is. Here's a black hole, and nothing can get out of it. Any light ray, any material object is trapped. Here's a white hole. Anything can get out of it. It's the time reverse solution. And this is a good approximation to the beginning, the Big Bang. The singularity exists, but it's in the opposite direction, which is why I can't answer the question, what is the origin of the universe? I can trace the evolution of the universe back in time from day to day, and all is well, the physics holds together, and we seem to have a consistent story until I reach day one. I go to day minus one, and the theory refuses to cooperate. It comes to a halt, and we don't understand what's going on. Yeah.
If you were an observer at the central point, however, and you have the gravity slowing things down, you would see the more distant objects actually traveling slower than the more closely close ones, wouldn't you?
Yes, that's a good question. If I can state it, I look at more distant objects. I ought to see, because I'm looking, well, let me try and put it as I understand the effect. As I look at more distant objects, I see them earlier in the history of the universe. The expansion of the universe is being slowed down, so I'm seeing them when the universe was expanding more rapidly, and I ought to see an extra redshift of those objects, right? Couldn't I see this effect and use it to test the theory? People have been trying very hard to see the effect, and so far it's not been convincingly demonstrated. The problem is, you need a very good marker for the distance of the galaxy away to know how much redshift you expect, to know whether it has just the right redshift for its distance. You estimate the distance of a galaxy by looking at its luminosity, and that works quite well for nearby galaxies. But as you go to great distance, you're looking at the galaxy when it was young, and there's no guarantee that a young galaxy has the same luminosity as these old fellows that we know and love nearby. In particular, they're expected to be brighter because they had more young stars in them, and young stars tend to be bright. Untangling that effect has proved to be intractable so far. In principle, you're right, we ought to see the effect of the deceleration of the expansion in an anomaly from the law redshift proportional to distance. But it hasn't been seen, unambiguously. Yes? Okay, I'll take your second question first because I think it illustrates science very well for what its science is. If the universe is 10 billion years old, how can there be stars 16 billion years old? Right? The hope is that when we've sorted out all the data and got our theories right, the oldest stars will be slightly younger than the universe. One does recognize that reckoning the age of a star is a very chancy business. You have to understand in detail what's going on inside a star. How much convection has there been? How much addition of material through time? How much loss of material from the atmosphere? All of these are very difficult to reckon, and they are needed if you are to reckon very carefully the age of the star. So there's always going to be an error in the measurement of a star age. That error is quite large, plus or minus a considerable factor, fraction of that 16 billion years. There's a similar error in estimating the age of the universe from its expansion rate. So far, those errors overlap, and so we can say the theory is not shown to be inconsistent. If, as people work harder and harder and narrow the errors, a gap opens between the ages of the oldest stars and the age of the universe as reckoned from its expansion rate, and if the gap is such as the stars are older than the universe, we will have to say there is something fundamentally wrong. But we're not there yet. And I, being an optimist, assume we won't be forced to that horrible impasse. First question, why do these objects that form out of the Big Bang assume a spherical shape? Spheres tend to be common, I believe, because gravity tends to pull things, and if pressure opposes them, A sphere is a natural equilibrium shape. The Earth, if it weren't spinning, would relax to a spherical shape because gravity is pulling in, pressure pulling out, and that's a natural equilibrium. The Earth isn't exactly a sphere because it's spinning. You'll notice that some galaxies are way off from a sphere because they're spinning quite rapidly.
Perhaps you could have a couple more questions.
Okay, well, if there are any more. It seems strange to you that the original Big Bang should have the characteristics of a black body. That's all right as it happens. What one means by a black body is a body that is relaxed to statistical equilibrium. And the early universe would have just those properties because it would be dense. What's required for relaxation to thermal equilibrium is high density, so that any photon won't move very far before it is absorbed, re-emitted, absorbed, re-emitted, absorbed, re-emitted. And it's that statistical process of absorption and readmission that makes statistical equilibrium, that makes black body radiation. The universe isn't like that now. You unleash a photon from a star, and that photon almost certainly will travel through all time without being absorbed again. We know that because we look at the most distant galaxies, and they're not particularly attenuated in their light by any absorption. So indeed, if you formed the universe today or yesterday, it would be very surprising to see black body radiation in it. But if you formed it at high density, it wouldn't be surprising, I argue. Yes? What's it? If everything were homogeneous and in equilibrium at the start, and no central point, no boundary, then, oh, but it isn't expanding from a central egg, is it? Because there is no center point from which it's expanding. You've got to bend your mind to this non-intuitive notion of something that is homogeneous with no center and no edge and yet expanding.
Ladies and gentlemen, to express our gratitude to Dr. Peebles, I would ask Dr. Bolton. Ladies and gentlemen, it's really very hard to overstate the importance of the ideas to which Professor Peebles has been such an important contributor. In the last century, I think the most important idea, at least in science, was the theory of evolution, that large people like Professor Peebles emerged from little green animals. I think in our century, the biggest intellectual achievement has been the realization that our universe has a history and that we have a perspective within which we can ask all kinds of questions. And we heard many of those questions tonight. That clearly you have raised many questions in people's minds, but at least we have a framework within which we can ask those questions. These ideas are not only stimulating, they may even have some practical purpose. For instance, we may have to change our code of justice so that happy observer A, if he commits a misdemeanor, we will sentence him to time space trajectory B, where we do not even realize his dismal end. And for, yes, that is a good idea. Well, Professor Peebles, on behalf of everyone here, I want to thank you for coming out to Vancouver and giving us the framework within which we can ask all of these questions and perhaps have puzzling questions which are going to bother us for a long time, and to which many people here may want to seek answers. Thank you.